The very first time I heard the term, it was intriguing to me, the very first time I heard it. For others, it kind of set off a torrent of rock-hard, adamant resistance. The very first time I heard the term, I was about 12 or 13, somewhere along that way. My youthful curiosity was equally matched by veteran suspicion and skepticism. A lady I had a high regard for, she was the pianist for the male chorus that I had joined at the age of 12 when I joined the Baptist Church. She was the accompanist. And so what she said, and I called her Miss Marie, she was a single parent, daughters, one of them probably close to my age, but she was Miss Marie. And when the pastor made the announcement, this was a Baptist pastor, that he was going to be teaching the congregation on a subject that I had never heard before, but it intrigued me, and he was going to be telling them what the Bible had to say about tithing. And her response to that versus my youthful vigor was, "Ain't nobody going to tell me what to do with my money." And she said, "Hey." I thought, that's a strange response from this lady I have this high regard for. The man said he was going to teach what the Bible has to say about it. Is she stonewalling God? Is she stonewalling the Bible? I don't quite understand that response. Well, he actually never gave a sermon on that subject, but lo and behold, there began to be a practice within that small congregation of tithing. They had a box constructed that on every Sunday you could come and put your tithes in the box labeled tithes. And then, of course, they had a number of passing of the trays during the course of the service, benevolent offering, free will offering, all kinds of offerings. You know, the only thing that was missing was an altar, you know, where you could put a lamb up on it or something like that, because there were a lot of offerings. But I remember in my youth and when I began to work after I graduated from high school, I was making $70 a week. And so $7 every week would be put in an envelope as my tithe. Now, at the same time, I was getting this literature from this far-off place called Ambassador College Press or something like that. And lo and behold, they confirmed this notion of tithing, but I only sent a couple of dollars out there because my main tithe was going to this church that I attended faithfully, you see. And that whole intrigue began to continue, but as I began to get more and more literature from that far-off place, I reversed the process. The $7 for tithes went off to a place in Pasadena of people I had never seen, knew anything about. And the $2 went to the local church because I was asking a lot of questions about doctrine and Bible stuff, and the pastor wasn't answering too well. So my point was that I'm being served by this organization out there that I don't even know if there's anybody existing except that guy on the radio. I never could quite figure out who it was. Was it Herbert or Garner? I just could never quite. He was talking so fast, you see. But it was exciting to come into the knowledge of this truth. And tithing is an issue that really stirs up a lot of folk in it. When this woman says, "Ain't nobody going to tell me about what to do with my money," a lot of people have that response. A lot of people have that approach and that attitude. I soon learned that money matters. Money matters to a lot of people, but many are very mistaken on matters of money. And so today, let's review for some and introduce to others three principles of biblical money matters. Now, a sermon on tithing can go for a long time. You can go for days talking about it. But I won't do that. I'm going to cull it down to three principles. But I'm going to give a disclaimer. Because when you give a message like this, the first thought is, uh-oh, they're talking about money. They must want some more. This is not about getting you to give more money to the CGI. Not at all. Now, some will be motivated to give like I was when I first began to hear about this thing called tithing. the typical biblical approach today of some fundamentalists. God said it, I believe it, and that settles it, or something to that effect. And so they deal with it like that. And others who will be hearing this tape down the road, perhaps next week when they get it in their mail, will be enticed or induced or inspired to contribute to even other organizations that serve their needs. That's a possibility. But I thought that we should at least begin to deal with the overriding principle involving tithing. This is one that the Church of God International came to very early on. I'll never forget the meeting where all of the ministerial council got together and we were discussing the issue of tithing, because there were those who felt, well, tithing shouldn't be taught. And others felt very adamantly that it should be. And we came to this seminal statement: tithing is an act of worship between an individual and God. It's a simple statement. It means then that it doesn't have to be policed. It doesn't have to be examined. It's not a requirement for fellowship or any such thing like that. It is simply an act of worship between an individual and their God. Now, that presents some problems, of course. I remember the old radio preacher, see if I can remember his name, Curtis Springer. Anybody ever remember hearing a guy named Curtis Springer as a preacher? Probably it's years ago, he's dead now. But he used to have a voice like this. I'm Curtis Springer, coming to you from Sizak Mineral Springs in Arizona. That's where he was from. And he would get into the point where he would ask for offering or tithes, and he'd say, now, when you send those checks, be sure to address them to Curtis Springer. I have trouble endorsing those checks addressed to God. The point was that if you're going to make a donation to God or contribute to God, there is a vehicle by which that can be accomplished. It was accomplished early on in the scriptures, which we'll get into, to deal with the question, well, if I'm going to give to God, how do I give to God? Well, he set a mechanism in motion to accomplish that. And we will see that as we go on. So tithing is overriding a principle of giving, or an act of worship, an individual act pronounced in favor of God, or an appreciation to God for gifts that he has given to us. Now, the very first principle I want to share with you is that, and this is a tough one for Miss Marie, see, God owns everything. That's the first principle. God owns everything. In fact, he is the universal donor. Universal donor means that there is nothing that anybody has that didn't originate from God. Now, if that is the sense of God having to speak on an issue like tithing, I would think that people would listen. Now, I'm going to guess that in years later, Miss Marie changed her mind. And really did become a tither. I believe that she did do that. I never hear her apologize to these young ears of a kid who was impressed, like, man, how could she have that attitude? How could she have that approach? But people do. But the very first time that tithing is mentioned specifically is in Genesis 14. And many of us are familiar with it. It's where Abram, this is before his name has been changed, this is where Abram goes after his nephew Lot, fights a battle against some of the people who took spoils of that situation, or the accumulation of wealth, shall we say. And he did a strange thing in chapter 14 of Genesis, beginning in verse 17. Then after his return, this is Abram's return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is King's Valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now, he was a priest of God Most High. This is not a sermon about Melchizedek, but it's interesting that what is about to transpires with a servant of God, priest-servant, if you will. That's what's about to happen here. And this king of Salem, Melchizedek, the priest of God Most High, blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High." I'm reading from the New American Standard Translation. "Who has delivered your enemies into your hand?" And he, being Abram, gave him, Melchizedek, a tenth of all. Now, prior to this, there's no injunction, no requirement that this be done. So we peer into a little bit about the character of Abraham at this point in time. For some reason, or through some revelation, some knowledge, he came to understand this was an act of worship, displayed towards one who was representative or serving by the authority of God Almighty. He was called a priest named Melchizedek. And so Abram gave this to him. And look what transpires. The king of Sodom in verse 21 said to Abram, "Give the people to me and take the goods for yourself." Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to the eternal God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." Abram understood that. And we have a confirmation of that very thing in Psalm 24. We'll get to that a bit later. But he understood this principle, that I will take a thread of a sandal, thong, or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten, the share of the men who went with me, and he names them off, and let them all take a share. But notice, the first share went to the representative of God. Now, I could say it went to God, but that's like the story of the little boy who was being sent off to, I'll call it Sabbath school, but it actually was Sunday school, but he went off to Sabbath school, and his mother gave him two nickels. She said, "Now, one nickel is for the offering plate when it comes by, and the other nickel is so you can buy you a treat after church." Great. He goes down the road merrily along, skipping and hopping, and sure enough, one of the nickels fell out of his pocket, rolled out down a drain into a ditch. He couldn't get it. And he looked skyward and said, "Well, Lord, there's your nickel. Your nickel is down the drain." And that's the approach that many people have. I mean, God's nickel, it's kind of here, there, all over the place, but my nickel is my nickel. It's like the preacher, too, who took the big collection and, of course, enticed the people to give more. Give to it hurt you. You've heard that phrase before. And it all got into the election of the collection plate, right? And then he had the people pray and bow their heads, and then he tossed the collection up in the air and says, "All that the Lord wants, he can keep. All that falls down belongs to me." I mean, that's the approach that people have relative to God and whether he possesses everything or not, or whether he does own everything or not. And since the Bible is very clear and not silent on this question of tithing, it behooves us to want to get in line with this very first principle. God owns everything. He is the universal donor. And as a result of that, Abram here gives the first share, the tenth, through a mechanism of the priest-servant relationship. That's a very important principle that exists there. And knowing that in preaching a sermon like this, the people will hear it and be motivated, we have people on our mailing list who receive tapes who are members of all kinds of churches. And like I was, my tithe, I believe I should tithe. And where did it go? It went to the Baptist church. Until I began to recognize and evaluate, well, now who is really serving my needs? In this case, Abram recognized that he should make this offering to Melchizedek. Now, this account is repeated in a different form in Hebrews 7. And we get some more insight from the passage in Hebrews 7 about this tithing question. And it's put in such a way that it's irrefutable. Very much strongly indicated here. So in Hebrews 7, beginning in verse 4, the writer here is describing a great phenomenon. He says, "Now observe how great this man was to whom Abraham, the patriarch, gave a tenth of the choicest spoils." It is a real challenge, and it got to be a real challenge to me after I became a part of the church. First of all, you hear about, okay, I'm tithing. Oh, that's great. And then somebody mentions second tithe. Oh, no, second, what's that? Well, that's so you can finance your festival attendance and so forth. Oh, well, that makes sense. That's reasonable enough. And then, lo and behold, somebody comes along with a third tithe, and that's, you get salvation from that because that's put off for a couple of years. I mean, this third tithe question, the way it used to be explained. And then somebody jokingly comes up to you later and says, well, you have heard about the fourth tithe, haven't you? And so we have a lot of humor and feeling about it, but the fact of the matter is that the principle of tithing, of tenthing, if you will, is firmly etched within the scriptures. In fact, it poses a problem for those who would say, well, you know, the Old Testament is on hold. It really doesn't apply today. But curiously enough, even the most, shall we say, pronounced opponents to Sabbath observance believe in tithing. Isn't that amazing? Must be a motivation in there someplace that they would teach so strongly the issue of tithing from the New Testament, considering that the Sabbath also is present in that same New Testament, but they won't preach that. Must be a money thing. But anyhow, verse 4 says, now observe how great this man was to whom Abraham, the patriarch, gave a tenth of the choicest spoil. And those indeed of the sons of Levi who receive the priest's office have commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people. So, from this, without us wading through all of the scriptures from the Old Testament, in the book of the Pentateuch, you will find established firmly here that the law, the book of the law, established that the Levites should collect a tenth. And it gives a reason for that. They were to collect this from the people, that is, from their brethren, although these are descendants from Abraham. And we can learn from other scriptures very clearly the reason being that the Levites did not have an inheritance within the land when they took over the promised land. They didn't have a plot of land, just like Reuben had a plot of land, or like Benjamin had a plot of land from which they could produce their sustaining goods. And so their brethren were to contribute a tenth to the Levites so they could give themselves to the tabernacle and to the service of the tabernacle and to the service of God, whether they were priests or simply Levites carrying the tabernacle around through the wilderness and so forth. And once they were established in the land, to make sure that it was secure and all of that. So that's why that tenth came along in the codified system of the ancient Israelites. But it goes on to say here, but the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth. This is referring to Melchizedek. His genealogy didn't come through there. It was not traced from them, collected a tenth from Abraham, and blessed the one who had the promises. So Abraham, though already possessing promises, already given great gifts, found it incumbent upon himself to say, thank you for your great gifts. That's another aspect we'll get into later concerning this issue of tithing, money matters, if you will. So Abraham, though blessed and given great promises, continue to manifest an appreciative spirit. Verse 7 says, but without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. Abraham was blessed by the greater, being the Melchizedek. And verse 8 says, in this case, mortal men receive tithes. That was referring to the priesthood that existed in ancient days. But in that case, one receives them of whom it witnessed. It is witness that he lives on, referring again to Melchizedek, and so to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes. Really? He paid tithes within the loins of Abraham, who was later to be produced out of the loins from Isaac to Jacob, and Jacob having all the sons, including Levi. So in effect, Levi tithes while he was in the loins of Abraham. But he also tithed a tenth. That was something called a tithe of the tithe. You can look this up in Numbers 18. I won't refer to it right now. I'll turn to it. Numbers 18, verses 25 through 32, and Nehemiah 10, verses, I think it's 37 through 39, where it specifically identifies that in order to maintain the temple, and by the time of Nehemiah there was a temple, which they were in the process of refabricating and restoring the walls and all that kind of thing, a tenth of what the Levites got, that, and they lived off of the tithe, bear in mind, they took 10% of that and they also had to tithe. So it's just a part of the system that God instituted for some reason. We'll find out what that might be as we move along. And let's see, in verse 9, and so to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Interesting principles in such a short span of space regarding this question of tithing, to firmly illustrate that God owns everything. He owns everything. Look at Exodus 9. This is the passage dealing with Moses before Pharaoh. And Moses has an opportunity at this point to make a profound statement, which is going to be underscored and verified later by David himself regarding the ownership of all things. Exodus 9 and verse 29. This is after Pharaoh sent for Moses and Aaron and said to them, I have sinned this time. In verse 27, the Eternal is the righteous one, and I and my people are the wicked ones. Make supplication to the Lord, for there has been enough of God's thunder and hail. I will let you go, and you shall stay no more. Moses said to him, as soon as I go out of the city, I will spread out my hands to the Eternal. The thunder will cease, and there will be no hail no longer, that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. Very dramatic, would you say? So, Pharaoh, you control a few people, a mighty army, and you've got the people of Israel enslaved, and you think you're hot stuff, but you can't stop the thunder. You can't stop the hail. You have no control over these elements. The individual who has that power and control is the Lord, and he owns the earth. Psalm 24. A psalm, I think, familiar to many of us, has a different flavor, changes throughout it, but primarily it opens up with the astounding statement, the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. I think in the King James it has, and the fullness thereof. That means everything in it. Look at this. The world and those who dwell in it. He owns them. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers, this great God. And with that in mind, it would seem that the creation would want to know what the Creator expects. At least in this one little aspect, this one little notion of the tithe. The tithe. Some say that tithing only applies in an agrarian society or setting of ancient times. That's usually the argument that's presented. Well, you can't tithe unless you got corn and wheat and all those kinds of apparatus. Well, what if they had Ford Motor Company in Abraham's day? You think he would have tithed of all he possessed? Would he have lived by that principle and somehow figuring it out? But the agrarian society was what existed in those days. You had fruit of the earth, or something that ate of the fruit of the earth, an animal, or yourself. God had even expectation of dedicating firstborn. A strange idea that he would have such a notion. So some will say this, view this not in a rational, logical, or biblical way. Anything produced, used, rented, possessed temporarily, because even Jack Benny couldn't take it with him, is ultimately owned by God. That's who is the possessor of it. And this scripture and many others confirm that. So the first principle in dealing with the question of tithing is, well, who owns it? Who owns it? My bank account? Do I own it? Not really. I mean, it's not much to own. But I mean, you know what I mean. If I've got a lot of stock, who owns it? How many cars do I have? Do I own them? The bank probably has a little say about that in their estimation, but you understand the principle. There's nothing that we own. We have it temporarily. Even our children, we like to own them, but then we really don't because they're only with us temporarily. There's nothing that we possess of and by itself. It's all temporary. So since God owns everything, moving on to the second principle, since he owns everything, what do I do when I give him a tithe or more? What do I do? I mean, what am I doing? Well, the answer to that is the second principle. What we give is a reflection of our faith. What we give is a reflection of our faith. For instance, if you know of an organization that's doing good work, let's call it PATH for people who are outside of the East Texas area. PATH is an organization that is an acronym for People Attempting to Help. And many churches within the community contribute to this fund. It was founded by a lady, I think she was 90 when she founded it. She just died about a month or so ago, Gertrude Windsor in Tyler. Well-off lady, had done tremendous work in the East Texas area. But they help about 12,000 people per week through PATH. Now, if a person recognized that, you know, they're doing good work, I think I'd like to help along the way. Let's say a person was not connected with the church. You know, that would be a nice resource for tithing because it's an act of faith. I recall hearing of a man named Sebastian S. Kresge. Anybody ever hear of him? S.S. Kresge, you know. Well, all right, you heard of Kmart, right? Well, Kresge's was the producer of what we know of as Kmart now. The Kresge five and dime stores, I doubt if you can find them anyplace anymore. But Sebastian Kresge, this was the senior, believed in tithing. And he tithed all of his life. In fact, his son also believed in tithing, and there's a church in Detroit right now, Metropolitan Methodist Church, that is so well healed financially because of the Kreskes. Not only after they died did they leave their majority of their wealth to them, but also while they lived, they tithed. A number of well-known names and figures. You know when Bill Cosby sold the rights of his old Cosby Show, the one with the family and all of that? He sold it for $600 million. He got a third of that, $200 million. He wrote a check for $20 million to a college. I would call that a tithe, wouldn't you? There are people who have discovered this principle who recognize that it's a reflection of faith that you do what you do when you do the tithe. That's all it is. Now, if one comes to understand, as I have regarding the Church of God International, this is where I've cast my lot, and this is where I receive the benefits and service of the spiritual underpinning and all of that kind of thing, I should have some sense of community and some sense of recognizing that maybe I can help. And it's a reflection of my faith, like you and others who are listening will be listening to this. It is that reflection, but let's get confirmation. And the famous passage in Malachi, the third chapter. I find this fascinating, this chapter. First of all, some people are in financial straits where they say, there's no way in the world I can tithe. I mean, I can't even pay all the bills I have. Well, it is a reflection of faith in those situations. It only means that you may believe that I should tithe, but how will I get from here to there? It may take some creative action. It may take some redoubling of effort. It may take a lot of kinds of things of getting bills paid off to begin to get to that point, or it may take an outstanding amount of faith to say, God first, the rest second. I don't know. I can't speak for everybody on that score. Been there, done that. You know, in the days of the third tithe, how many can recount stories of what that was like? you know, how rough it was for some people. It got so rough in Pasadena, I think, for some of the employees who were not being paid, you know, a high wage in some circles, that Mr. Herbert Armstrong made a decision regarding employees working in the work being like Levites and therefore did not have to pay the third tithe. That, of course, went over well in the field. You know what I mean? That really kind of endeared the people to Pasadena. But those kinds of things did happen. My whole point, though, is that reflecting on our faith, I mean, what do we really believe regarding this? This passage identifies the question, will a man, verse 8, rob God? Wait a minute. If I'd asked Miss Marie, now, don't you know that if you don't take up this understanding of tithing that you're robbing God? I wonder what she would have responded. I wonder how she would have approached that, because her approach was, ain't nobody going to tell me what to do with my money. See, first of all, it wasn't her money. It was loaned. Now, we say, well, I earned it. I earned every dime of it, every farthing. I earned it. Well, in one sense, you did. But after the earning, there comes a responsibility. There comes a responsibility of what to do with it. And what we do with it is reflected in this question. What will a man rob God, yet you are robbing me? But you say, how have we robbed you? And the answer is, wow, in tithes and offerings, I think the King James says here, it says contributions. And as a result of that approach, you are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Now, God, who owns everything, doesn't need anything from us. What is he trying to stress when he says, you have robbed me? I own everything, yet you're robbing me. Is it a lesson that he's trying to teach us regarding faith? Yes. But about giving. Now, I could spend a lot of time talking to you about the priesthood of ancient Israel and take Eli's boys as examples as to why people wouldn't tithe. You know, the prophet Eli, the one that Samuel went to serve the temple and so forth. Well, his boys were crooks. Yeah, they lived off the tithe and more. They were ripping the people off under the mantle of being priests. That reality does exist. So in a matter of faith and making it concrete, we have to analyze what's happening, what's being done. And we try to keep people informed within the Church of God International because, you know, every week the phones are ringing. And every week so much literature goes out. Every week so many tapes go out. And we try every week. Sharon Hibbert over here takes care of that to make sure that a weekly report goes out to inform people. Here's what's happening. Now, yes, there are salaries to be paid and paper to be purchased and printing to be done and light bills to be paid and television equipment to buy and needing more lights over there too, right, Mark, so that I don't appear so dark when I'm on, on the TV with Mr. Armstrong. I mean, lots of things that go on. And if one is faithful to God and having the kind of faith that's required in this point number two, you will not. People will not rob God in that fashion. It's not about giving something to God because he needs it. We give to God because we need it. We need what he can provide us, what he can give us. And the attitude must be circumspect and very right in doing this. Let's read on. It says there, you are cursed with a curse. And as a nation, I found it fascinating during the political season hearing talk about a flat tax. And one of the figures that was thrown around, I believe, by a representative from Texas was 10%. I thought, man, that'd be interesting. That'd be a nice benefit for some of you on the high tax bracket. I don't know who all you all are, but you're the ones who are at the 29 to 28% level. That would be a nice break to come down to 10%. But I don't think it'll ever get any place because, first of all, you got 535 representatives up there with lots of opinions, some who are tithers. But what if as a nation, we were to live by that principle, 10%? You think God would kind of take a second look? Probably. says here, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, so there may be food in my house, and test me now in this. Now, God isn't eating the food, so why should there be food in his house, or supplements in his house, or materials in his house? Because out of his house goes the service of the people, speaking just from the temple point of view. And if we understand and transfer, as the book of Hebrews does, the idea that the priesthood was changed, the Levitical priesthood was going to be set aside, and the priesthood of Christ was going to be preeminent, that he established a ministry according to Ephesians and according to other scriptures in the Bible, and according to him establishing the apostles and so forth, how was that to be financed? And there's a lot of controversy about that. Well, you know, if tithing is to be taught, tithes should all stay in a given city, a locality. Well, that's all well and good, if that's all you want to do. If you just want to have a nice little tea party. But if there's an outreach program beyond that of reaching more people, there must be some kind of cohesive central effort. And the tithing system, competently applied, I think, will accomplish that. Going on here, it says, if you test me, if you try me, if I will not open up the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until there is no more seed. And many people get hung up on that when they say, well, you know, I've been tithing and I haven't been receiving no blessings. I haven't got out of debt. God is failing on this deal. Well, maybe you haven't learned the lesson yet that he wants you personally to learn. There may be a lesson in there because it comes out in the attitude here as we proceed on. Continuing, and all the nations will call you blessed, for you shall be a delightful land, says the Eternal of Hosts. Great principles in there. I wish I could spend more time in it, but I'm going to have to hurry along. Whether a person has a widow's mite or careful quantifying of his tithe, attitude is important. For instance, now I'll just refer to these because most of you know these scriptures, Matthew 23:23. And Luke 11:42, and Luke 18:12. These all refer to Pharisees' tithing. Christ in Matthew 23 told them, woe be unto you, scribes and Pharisees, for you tithe of every little thing. I mean, you got it down to a microscope. Anise, cumin, the little mustard seeds. You tithe of all of those things and let you leave some weightier matters undone, such as justice and other things there. The three things that he mentions that don't pop into my mind, figuring out as old as you get, you have to write stuff down. It doesn't pop into your mind as frequently as it used to. So there was an attitude problem. In the example of Luke 18, where the Pharisee, the Levite, goes up to the temple, Lord, I thank thee that I'm not like other men, extortioners and all that kind of thing. I fast twice in the week, and I tithe of all that I possess. And this man was not being blessed, or anybody else who tithes with a notion, boy, I'm going to get paid. I'm going to get some good stuff out of this act of faith. No, that's not how it works. That's not the approach. That's not the intent. God didn't send his son, Jesus Christ, to die with the idea that he's going to get paid, that he's going to get somehow significantly better finance. That's not it at all. In fact, what God did was to give to receive us. In the giving, we establish this reflection of our faith in the right attitude. Look at Amos, the fourth chapter. Amos 4, where an important statement is put down for us. And verse 4. Enter Bethel, this is Amos 4 and verse 4. Enter Bethel and transgress. In Gilgal, multiply transgressions. Bring your sacrifices every morning, your tithes every 3 days. This was supposed to be part of what was supposed to be done. But the problem is, if you do it in the wrong perspective, with the wrong approach and the wrong attitude, it doesn't work for you. The one principle that we extract from 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 7, you don't have to turn there, but you might make note of it, is that God loves a cheerful giver. One that has an attitude of, it's not begrudgingly, it's not because I'm compelled to, it's not because God will hammer me if I don't. That's not it. That's not the approach. In reflecting our faith, it has to be done from a pure heart, because that leads to the third point. God does not expect us to give our tithes or our offerings in a legalistic perspective. Giving is never legalistic. It is merely saying thanks. Since we can't look in the manger like the shepherds, and it's that time of the year, so I thought I'd just kind of throw that in there, though we should think about looking in the manger all year long, that God would allow human beings to handle his son. Human beings to handle him, and nurture him, and bring him up to age, and then let him go on his own to do his mission. Since we can't stand on the shores, most of us, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee and gaze out to where Christ did his mighty, many wonderful works, nor can we peer into the empty garden tomb, how do we say thanks for all of the benefits that come to us? How do we accomplish that? Since giving is never legalistic and it's not about being like the Pharisees, tithing of every little bit, but it's about an attitude of thanksgiving. How do we accomplish that? How does that happen? Well, God gives us a system, and it's up to us to have our attitude reflecting it properly. Look at Matthew 22 as we move towards the close. Matthew 22, verse 34. This is an occasion when Christ reveals a profound principle. The Pharisees heard that he had put the Sadducees to silence, and they were happy about that. They gathered themselves together and they said to him, a lawyer asked the question, what is the great commandment of the law? And he extracts out of Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter and verse 5, this statement. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. In Deuteronomy it says, might versus mind. I got to thinking about that. Well, if I'm supposed to love God with all of that, is my money included in that? Is that part of my might? Are my possessions part of my might? And if my mind spends a lot of time figuring out how to make more of it, money that is that something that I might find a way to express thanksgiving to God regarding? I can't go back to the first century and deal with all those things that existed with Christ walking the earth, and I've never seen him except embodied in the lives of other people. How will I say thanks? He goes on to say, this is the great and foremost commandment in verse 38, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And on these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. And I got to thinking of how to apply that to manifest our thanksgiving. Well, you know, I was over in Columbus, Georgia last Sabbath, and that little Baptist church that, to the time I was 10 years old, that my mother sang in the choir, and I used to sit on the front row because she wouldn't let us sit any place but the front row, because if we acted up, she could come out of the choir stand and get it all straightened out, you know, real fast. she didn't play. Anyhow, I sat in the parking lot of that little church because we had a group of 25 for Sabbath services, and Saturday night I just kind of drove around reminiscing. I grew up in a project, Booker T. Washington Apartment, one of the first projects that they built in the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s, and just reflected on where I am today and the route and the way of coming through and sitting and talking with my 81-year-old uncle about how it used to be and all those kinds of good things. And a certain air of thankfulness came forward. Now, I can thank God in a lot of ways. I can do it verbally. I can do it in serving other people. But I can also do it with substance. Now, friend of mine, I heard tell of the story of wondering with his mother one day whether his father had remembered the important things that they had enjoyed together, like going to a Pittsburgh Pirates baseball game when the St. Louis Cardinals were playing one time, and it was a doubleheader. This man accounts that he had taken his glove, you know, with his dad, and it was like his chest was stuck out to here, and it was tingling up his spine that he was with his dad. He was out of this game, and when it was time to go home, of course, they had the hot dogs and the whole bit, you know. And when it was time to go home, he did a simple thing that the man telling this account had forgotten, but his father never forgot, of this young boy slipping his hand into his father's hand and saying, "Thanks, Dad." And his mother reminded him in his query about, well, did Dad ever know that I loved him and really appreciated him? And she recounted that story because he said, you know, your dad never forgot that. He talked about it all the time. That one simple little act of saying thank you. And it got to reflecting on this relative to tithing. You know, it's not a grudgery thing. It's not an awful thing. It's not a thing that we should go at as like God's trying to get something from me. But rather, it's a way of saying thanks. You know, I'm not a mathematician, but I think mathematicians would have a problem with this scenario. 90% goes further or farther, whichever you choose, than 100%. I mean, how can that be? How could it possibly happen that way? But from Genesis 14 forward, that is the scriptural indication that we should anticipate that God expects us to survive very nicely on 90%. And that it will go further, farther, than 100. Now that's an act of faith, to believe that. I hope that we will consider it at this year's end, in the wake of Thanksgiving and all of those good things that we have had, and even with the stress of our lives and the difficulties that confront us and paying off our bills. It would seem, as that youthful kid that I was when I first heard the word tithing, it intrigued me, and I'm grateful to God that He's allowed me to, with ups and downs, continue to manifest an appreciation by being able to simply say, thanks.